Ah, The Flight of the Bumblebee. You know, it was composed in 1900 by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, and the piece is meant to evoke the ever-changing flying pattern of a bumblebee. And, you know, I think we probably have all heard that song at one point or another. And much of the music we enjoy, or a lot of it at least, and a lot of the food we eat, and a lot of the art that we admire has its basis with insects. And at least that's the argument that our UW La Crosse entomology professor makes, Barrett Klein, in his new book. His new book is titled The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. It's a very illuminating book told in a very entertaining way. I really enjoyed it a lot. And I know we're going to enjoy talking with him. And we'll have some more music as we go along that relates to insects as we visit with Barrett. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. How much gratitude do we owe the countless insects on our planet? What do you think? What's your view on that? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bart Klein, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Wow, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be with you, Larry.
I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book. You know, and there's a little blurb from Doug Tallamy, who a lot of our listeners know, on the back of the book. He says, the insect epiphany has substantially broadened my appreciation of insects with a fascinating dive into the services beyond the ecological ones that they perform. Indeed, this book has given me my own unexpected epiphany that insects have impacted human culture and molded our lives in myriad ways that I hadn't imagined. Well, you know, for Doug Tallamy to say that, I think that's pretty nice.
And that is no surprise to me, because as an entomologist, and even a cultural entomologist who looks at those intersections between humans and insects, I was surprised every day when researching this book.
I tell you, it was so much fun to read. I wondered as I read, why the heck haven't we learned this before? Why has the impact of insects on human history gone so far unrecognized?
You know, I think part of it has to do with our focus on our negative associations with insects. And while they're vastly outnumbered by the insects who are essential to our livelihoods and our well-being, they are important, and we can't dismiss, for example, Anopheles mosquitoes, vectors of malaria, and the rat flea, who can be a vector of the bubonic plague, and some others. But if we look at all those minute hexapods that affect every aspect of our life, they can go under the radar oftentimes. And part of that has to do with the fact that their products may coat things around us, may affect and inspire artists producing works in ways that aren't as overt or explicit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. And actually, I was thinking about it. Right at the start of the book, you talk about what would the world be like without insects? And you kind of get into that. Just give us a brief look at that.
Well, we wouldn't be long for this world to admire.
No, we'd be long gone.
Because the initial knee-jerk response by many people will be, oh, great. I want to have those cockroaches running the dead of night through my kitchen. I want to have termites chewing on my, you know, floorboards. I want to have insects that could sting or cause disease or wreak havoc on crops, right? But then when you think more carefully about the ecosystem services the roles that insects can play, from pollination to soil aeration, nutrient dispersal, decomposition, as well as serving as food for others, we would be in a mess without insects.
We'd be in a
literal mess with the dung and the carcasses all around us.
I thought
but
that
then
was
add on to that. Yeah. Add on to that the cultural services that are recognized: honey, silk, cochineal, and the unrecognized, or at least the less recognized.
I was, I hadn't even thought about getting rid of organic, getting rid of waste.
That's huge.
Dung beetles.
So imagine the first influx of cattle to Australia. And those decomposers that we're used to, we have the luxury of decomposers that will quickly eliminate cattle dung. Australia didn't have that. The marsupials aren't ready for this huge, voluminous mass of moist fecal matter. So what did they have to do? People brought in exotic dung beetles only to have them roll away the dung of these exotic cattle.
that's just I swear it's a thousand stories that are in your book that really caught my attention. And you know, the whole bit about pollination. I mean, we insects, what did you say? One in every three bites we consume?
If you can imagine, if you take three bites of food, for the average person, the average bites, one out of every three is thanks to an animal pollinator. And sure, there are bats who pollinate, there are birds who pollinate, but by and large, most of them are insects. We think about bees, and many of your listeners, although I know you had an entomologist just beforehand, so you've got some very educated listeners here, but many people will think one species, Apis mellifera, honeybees. But bees themselves number 20,000 strong described species, and those are all pollinators, or most of them are. And then you've got flies, butterflies, moths, beetles were some of the original pollinators of angiosperms or flowering plants. So all those flowering plants that produce the seeds, the nuts, the fruits on which we depend, yikes.
Yikes indeed. I stole from your book for the first segment of the today's show because we were talking happened to be talking about ants. And the total number of ants alone, 20 quadrillion, which would be
mind around that number.
1.25 billion per person. So I don't know where my 1.25 billion are, but they're out there. And there's over a million described species.
That's right, 1.1 million described species, and their thoughts that at least one, possibly two magnitudes more undescribed species are waiting to be revealed to science.
How did you get into this whole area of, and maybe define cultural entomology for us, and how you yourself became interested in it?
Oh, that was really easy. So, Larry, I know you're probably a closet entomologist at heart, as we all are. And for me, it was the ripe old age of five that I got into insects. But it did take a while before I understood the hidden ways. Not just, hey, we get honey and beeswax and propolis from honeybees. We get cochineal dye from these scale insects, etc. But then learning to the extent to which insects impact our lives have fed into literature, art, music, war, politics, every facet of human culture that we can think of. Whether you're a lawyer or a plumber, insects are involved in some way. That really intrigued me. So I come from a family of artists, so I was intrigued by the beauty, the aesthetics of insects, as well as the diverse behaviors. So I wanted to explore that from a scientific standpoint, But then learning about how, wow, the very art that I admire has insects behind the curtain. So I explored that. And then it panned out to, wow, I want to explore this in a deeper way and a broader way. So the book gave me an excuse to explore the depth and breadth of our insect associations.
You know, one of the early in the book, you have a whole piece on silk and silkworm and the silkworm. And I was just, that blew my mind right off the bat. You tell a story about how it was even discovered, the story of, was it a princess or queen or something that discovered the thread of silk.
Yeah, would you like me to read that part?
Yeah, read that part.
Dislodged from a high tree branch by a curious crow, a cocoon falls. Inside, a single plump larva, after weeks of eating, growing, molting, then building and transforming, is on the verge of molting again, this time to reveal legs, compound eyes, and wings. Plummeting from her high perch, the larva's quiet transition into a moth is interrupted by a soft landing in a hot cup of tea. Nothing in her species' evolutionary history prepared her for the heat that melts the glue binding the fibers of the walls that encase her. And after this, you learn that Lei Zhu, this Chinese empress, witnesses the unraveling of the single silk strand. So imagine this. A silk moth lays an egg, hatches into a larva as larva grows, feeds on mulberry leaves, and then ultimately spins a single strand of silk that could be a mile long around her developing body so that she can eclose as a winged adult later. Now, in order to use that silk, which Lei Zhu noticed, according to legend, as being a single strong strand that's lustrous in its hues and shimmering qualities, we have to heat treat or kill the individual. Why? Because as they emerge, they chew their way out. And if you chew their way out, then you can't wind up into skeins, this single strong shimmering fiber.
It is amazing. And of course, the development of the silk industry was enormous.
Yeah, it basically made or broke some nations. Japan would not have been the military powerhouse had it not become the economic powerhouse thanks to silk exports.
And that silk, I mean, all that silk is coming from, individual silkworms.
One species of over 180,000 species of Lepidoptera, moths and butterflies, they all spin silk. But we've domesticated Bombyx mori to such an extent, they utterly rely on us. They can't even fly on their own. So humans go extinct, Bombyx mori goes extinct.
And I thought the whole business of the Silk Road was really interesting.
Connecting much of the old world, you had this network, which primarily was focused on the commerce related to silk, but then all these other material goods and immaterial or non-tangible goods in the form of language, spirituality, religion, and all these other cultural facets plummeted those roads. Even the Great Wall of China was fortified in part to defend based on the Silk Road.
Oh, and the Black Plague.
Yeah, that there are downsides. Whenever humans connect very closely, what does that mean? Increase in spread of disease. So the irony that commerce and connectedness, including the spread of ideas, started with this Bombyx mori silkworm moth only for a flea vectoring a bacterium on the backs of a rat initiated the spread of the Black Plague.
Bart Klein, our guest today, professor of entomology at the UW La Crosse. His book is titled The Insect Epiphany, subtitled How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. Questions, thoughts, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. The Fly. That was recorded by Chubby Checker in 1961. What you heard at the beginning of the song, by the way, was not a buzzing fly. Sounded like one, but it wasn't. It was the sound of an electric shaver. But that song reached number 7 on the U.S. pop chart. So a pretty popular song, and there again connected with our one insect, the fly. Continuing our conversation about insects and their impact on human culture with Bharat Klein, professor of entomology at UW La Crosse and author of The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. Again, you can join in, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call. David in Deerfield, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I just want to say thanks very much for your interesting program today. And my dad was a 7th and 8th grade science teacher. So from a very early age, you know, our family ended up doing a lot of things that other families didn't. But I remember him talking about the importance of silk in ancient China, because they had a way to make tea bags so they wouldn't get tea leaves in their tea anymore. They made tea bags out of silk.
David, thanks for calling. And Bharat, comment?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The range of uses of silk, impossible to count. I mean, just to give you an idea, apparently every munitions fired during World War I by the U.S. was in a bag of silk. And the reason is that if you burn it, it doesn't leave any trace behind. But also silk is mighty strong. It has that luster that we love. And depending on what species you extract it from, the qualities vary tremendously.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that comment. Appreciate it. I know you're a bee guy, for sure.
You know, yeah.
So honeybees. And for centuries, people have prized honey and beeswax. And you certainly write about this in the book, very entertainingly, by the way.
Thank you.
But people have also made use of honey, other uses of honey, one as a preservative.
Oh, yeah. You've got adhesive, medicinals, not just food, but you're right, preservative. And the reason is it's hygroscopic. It draws water out of the air, so it'll draw water out of bodies. So instead of putrefying with that water content, you can be better preserved. It's a similar idea as salt drawing water out of the body. But more than that, honey has antimicrobial agents, so it can even combat or fend off those organisms that would contribute to decomposition.
Oh, it's fantastic. Jan in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I'm just listening to you guys talk, and it's just so cool. But one of my very favorite flowers is pollinated by the fly. But the flower is on the ground. Can you guess what it is?
Is it clover?
No, it's a wild ginger.
Oh, great. So would you believe
and
that?
It's a beautiful burgundy flower that has a long throat, and it's covered up by all of the vegetation, and people rarely get to see that flower, but it is beautiful.
I love it. Now, do you happen to know what kind of fly it is? Because oftentimes the number two pollinator out there behind bees are flies, especially hoverflies in the family Syrphidae. And while we can be easily confused between flies and bees, flies belong to the order Diptera, diptera means two wings in Greek. And so they only have one pair of wings, with the hind wings modified little gyroscopic balancing organs. And also the heads are very different. The mouth parts are very different. The antennae are very different. Yet these highly valued pollinating hoverflies are often used in advertisements, on book covers, in movies, representing bees, mistakenly.
Jan, thanks a lot for contributing that. I appreciate it very much. I want to get back to honey for just a minute, because there was one thing that another thing that interested me was that you argue that the skills needed to find and obtain honey and the value of honey in eating may have given our human ancestors a competitive advantage.
Yeah, this is an argument, and I mean, it's definitely debated because it's all hypothetical, but it's an argument made by anthropologists and archaeologists that, say, for example, in this most recently discovered, most detailed and sophisticated vision of honey robbing on a cave wall in Spain, dates 7,500 years ago. And what happened? You had a couple of humans creating this looped rope that would scale a cliff face so that one could steal the honey and beeswax and probably brood as food from the honeybee nest. Now, what happens then is you've got so many resources that could not only supplement the diet of these earlier human lineages and groups, but also think about devising the technology simply to access and acquire and process all of that beeswax and honey. Were those two, the sustenance, the high carbohydrate rich food source from the honey, as well as the protein from the brood, and coupled with the need to acquire it, did that contribute to our brain growing? So innovation, need for innovation, coupled with sustenance. These are the ideas.
Yeah, fascinating. Ellen in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for the show, by the way. It's my favorite. And I appreciate being able to ask this question. So I planted an organic fruit orchard 2 years ago. It's in Vernon County. And this last summer, spring and summer, I had ant hills gathering at the base of some of them. I knocked them down and put some diatomaceous earth. I wondered, and that didn't seem to affect them at all. And I wondered, you know, I thought maybe because we have clay soil that it was, they're helping to aerate the soil, but then I was also concerned they were eating the roots and might kill the trees. So I was just curious if you have any tips for when I might do this next season.
Here's my biggest piece of advice. Embrace those ants. Love those insects and celebrate the diversity in your garden. Now, some of these ants are carnivores, they're predators, they're hunters, and they'll only do good for your garden in terms of hunting herbivorous insects. And as you say, aerating the soil, potentially spreading nutrients and the like. Others are harvesters, others are vegetarians or omnivores, and potentially feeding on, if you're growing fruits and the rest. There's the potential there. But all in all, I'd celebrate the diversity and step back. Don't use that diatomaceous earth and certainly don't spread chemicals.
All right, Ellen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to bees just once more. I should have had you explain the book and how it's laid out, but you have various sections. One section is fight like an insect or dance like an insect, another act like an insect, dress like an insect or sound like an insect, and act like an insect. Under that section, you had Tom Seeley from Cornell University. He's probably an old colleague. You studied at Cornell as well. but had honeybee democracy for us to follow. And there were five rules. And the reason I wanted to bring those rules in, because it also helped describe the nature of how honeybees or how bees work as a colony. And, you know, I think the first one was he had 5 points.
Yeah.
Honeybee democracy. Well, you probably have them and you probably know them.
I do. I'm happy to recite them. So, yes, Tom Seeley is not only a colleague of mine, he's my honeybee mentor and dear friend. And his book, The Honeybee Democracy, does something really special. So it talks about honeybees and their decision-making and ends with a final chapter where he claims to learn how we can learn from honeybees in terms of, under certain circumstances, better communicating and decision-making. And his five rules here: first, compose a group with shared interests and mutual respect rather than of clashing curmudgeons. That helps, right? So you can at least start to be productive. Second, minimize the influence of a leader. Now, this is really important.
Well, how do bees do that?
Well, so the queen, we think, oh my goodness, the monarch, she's in control of anything. Baloney, she lays eggs. That's it. So she has her job. But the collective interests across the tens of thousands of honeybees that may number in a colony are doing their own jobs. There's a division of labor. And there are no leaders, and no one voice will prevail. So what does that mean? That means decision-making is made truly democratically in many cases, and it becomes a numbers game, where the more who advertise for that distant food source will win the day. But that doesn't eliminate the smaller voices for alternative food sources. And how can that help a honeybee colony? Well, say the one food source is overtaken by a competitor or destroyed in some way. You have the fallback, you have the contingency plan, you have the alternatives, which continue to be advertised by others. So the third, seek, and this is really important, seek diverse solutions to a problem. Don't go with that one idea and run with it and not look back. Fourth, engage in an open competition of ideas and build support among voters until a quorum, that minimum number necessary to conduct business, is reached.
And how do they do that?
Oh, so it's great. So it depends. Like if honeybees engage in what's called a waggle dance. Now picture this, Homo sapiens, humans. We have this strange way of abstractly communicating. We can draw a map. We can speak. We can dance, right? We can do all these things. Who else among the animals can do this? No other primate can do it in the way we can. In fact, you have to go back over 540 million years to a shared ancestor, and then go back up another lineage of invertebrates until you get to this small group, this genus of Apis, of honeybees. And how do they do it? Well, say you're Larry. So you're a worker honeybee, and they're all females. They do all the work. You fly off and you, as a scout bee, and you find a distant food source, say blossoming flowers. And you fly back, a beeline, straight back to your colony. And then instead of having to drag bees out, you perform a dance, a waggle dance. And the very flight relative to the sun transposed on the vertical comb is the same angle that you wiggle your abdomen as the angle relative to the sun. So you're telling direction. But not only that, the duration you waggle before you turn around, 1, 2, turn around, 1, 2. Those 2 seconds can correlate with distance, maybe 2 kilometers to that food source. So now you've advertised to your nest mates how many are advertising for this site versus that site, and how vigorously, how many waggle runs do you engage in? Those are the numbers that matter.
So that's engagement in open competition,
right?
Of ideas.
That's exactly right.
And you're building support of among voters until a quorum is reached.
Yes, that's right. And so that minimum number. But then, you know, you have to make that decision. So you have to cut it off at some point. And that becomes especially important. People, your listeners have probably seen a swarm of bees or heard them in a tree in their yard upon occasion. I saw it every week in the summer because I had bees in my backyard, right? But what is that swarm? All it is a fraction of a colony attempting to find a new place to live, a new home. So they perform the same exact waggle dance that advertises a food site to, say, a hole in a distant hollow tree, because they're cavity nesters. So you'll see, if you take your binoculars out and you watch that swarm, you'll see dances on the surface, and you'll see different dances advertising different sites until finally one, it converges on a single direction, and you see them all waggling in one direction, and then soon after that, they'll rise en masse in the air, and a swarm will whirl around, and they'll head in that one direction.
Oh, boy. Laura in Portage has a comment or question. Let's go there. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Years ago, I heard something about figs and wasps and how, I don't know, the wasps nest in the fig blossom or something, but one can't live without the other. And I don't remember any particulars, except it sounded interesting.
That is absolutely on the money. So there are many specialist pollinators, including the yucca and yucca moth. If one goes, the other would go extinct. And fig species perform the same task of pollination. And I'm sad to say, happy to say, if you chew on a fig, you're eating the dead bodies of male fig wasps, because they're stuck in there.
They're stuck in there, Laura. There you go. Oh, my goodness. You write that nearly every object around us, speaking of that, is likely composed of or covered by bug secretions.
Or could be.
Or could be.
Historically, so say, for example, if one of your listeners has a shiny apple or a shiny piece of candy by their side, or maybe a shiny floorboard or wall or piece of furniture, they may be covered with the secretions of lac insects. So scale insects are somewhat nondescript when they're female. And what they do is they protect themselves. This is all about protecting themselves so that they can feed on plants. And how do they do that? They secrete this lac on top of themselves, and it's this hard secretion, and they can run underneath that and feed without problems on the plant, except that an entrepreneurial human comes by and collects stick lac and then processes that stick lac by breaking it up and pulverizing it and then putting in a liquid vehicle, and now all of a sudden you can paint on or spray shellac. And so if you take the natural form of shellac, this can serve not to protect the insect feeding on a plant anymore, but it can serve as armor or protection of your furniture or, say, a shiny coat on your apple or candy. So we even historically used to cover our bodies cosmetically with a dye or spray our hair so we'd have that perfect coiffure, or paint on our nails for nail polish, and consume various dyed beverages and foods. So the lac insect and other scale bugs have played a huge role and continue to. In fact, even 78 RPM records were made from the lac, from lac insects.
Oh, fascinating. And you mentioned somewhere along the line, color came in, and red dye You tell a fascinating story in the book about red dye and its relation to an insect.
And I highly recommend the book. Amy Butler Greenfield wrote The Perfect Red and basically weaves the story of this this single different species of scale insect. So I draw from different aspects of history and biology when I write about this species, because it really did, just like silk in some ways, make or break economies. So picture over 1,000 years by Aztecs and the Maya of raising this single beautiful scarlet dye-producing scale bug, which feeds on prickly pear cacti. They would process that dye and then produce gorgeous, brilliant red textiles. Well, Spanish conquistadors sweep in, and second only to silver, their export of cochineal altered the old world as it had the new world. People raved over the red. So imagine now the clergy adorning themselves in red robes, Caesar and his family in red. So nobility in red, right? From cochineal. Now, there had been natural reds in the old world, madder and other species of scale bugs, but this more potent, more effective, more brilliant. So it spread. Artists loved it. Much later, Van Gogh's works, even though he knew that red was not light fast and would fade when exposed to ultraviolet, he lathered his canvases with the brilliant reds of cochineal. Even upon penalty of death, the conquistadors, knowing the value of this, would not allow the secrets of cochineal bugs to leave. So it took this French botanist to sneak in and surreptitiously remove the cochineal bugs on prickly pear and try to establish them elsewhere before the secret leaked to the rest of the world.
Barrett Klein, our guest today, and his book is titled The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. Join in with your own thoughts, questions, or comments. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Wasp Man by The Who. Wasp Man by The Who. Let's see, that was released in 1972 as a B-side to the single The Relay. We're continuing our conversation with UW La Crosse entomologist Barrett Klein. And it's great to have him with us. Just to mention, tomorrow, speaking of music, we'll have the legacy of the late guitarist and Wisconsin native Les Paul, and I'm sure we'll be listening to some of Les Paul's music on tomorrow's show. And that brings me to sound. You argue that the sounds made by insects, which, you know, there's some sounds in that Who song, may have instilled our love for rhythm and music, the sounds of insects. Why do you think that?
Well, that's the thesis within the book Bug Music. And I think it holds some merit because insects are the choristers all around us, predate us by 400 million years. When Homo sapiens hit the scene, insects were courtship calling, aggressive calling, playing their music in various ways. So the very thumping of, the rhythms of the stridulating cricket varies in a soundscape night and day from cicadas to tree crickets, inspiring potentially a vast majority of our own music. Some of it quite explicit.
Yeah. One example that you, or one of the examples you show is Yoko Ono's 1971 recording. It was titled Fly, and it's 22 minutes. long. Well, we should listen to the whole thing, but we don't have time. No,
you really don't want
to listen to the whole thing. Let's listen to a sample from Yoko Ono's song "Fly." You got that up, Jeff?
Yes. And would you believe that her husband, whom your listeners may know, John Lennon, played his guitar that was played backwards that also sounded fly-like in concert with Yoko Ono?
So there we go. Another example of a composer finding explicit inspiration. François Schobert, a piece for violin and piano, titled "The Bee." I think we've got that one up. Lovely. It was composed in 1860, and from the perspective of an entomologist, how well does that piece capture the erratic flight of a bee?
Nothing even close to others who masterfully, I mean, yes, that's all, you know, beautifully evocative and poetic in terms of just the flight patterns. But what I find is all the more intriguing is the mimicry, the imitation. And you played Yoko Ono in her brilliant fly performance. And right on par with that, I would place the Dong people of China, where women will collectively play a chorus of cicadas. It's just beautiful.
We don't have that one, but you gave a good example of it. Oh, man. Tanya in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. I am so happy that you have this guest on. I personally live in a very farm-orientated community. And they just kill everything. They just kill every insect they could possibly kill, you know? And I've been studying the beneficial nematodes, and I'd like to know if you know anything more on that. And I think adding the insects to the soil to combat the bad bugs with the good bugs is so much more sensible than our practices that we have now.
That's a really excellent point. And so, for example, if we look at big agriculture, basically we're doing it all wrong. And it's a huge problem because even the output, the efficiency, economically, it doesn't make sense to have vast monocultures that we spray with chemicals that insects very quickly gain or evolve resistance to. So better to have a grander diversity for not only output of plants, but for a healthier ecosystem. And part of that ecosystem involves these competitors, predators, parasites, parasites who ultimately kill their hosts. And those roundworms you're talking about, if I were to remove all of planet Earth, there would be a halo of roundworms in valleys and mountains and forests. There's so many of them and they're so diverse, and they play key roles as well. So you're right that some roundworms mm-hmm. will attack and feed on the herbivores that we have problems with. So instead of spraying the chemicals or using genetically modified organisms, maybe we could harbor a more natural, ecologically friendly environment.
Tonya, thank you very much for calling. I wanted to, there's so many things in your book we haven't touched on, even a 1% of everything, but I wanted to mention eating insects. I remember I wrote a story when I was a young guy here at the UW, I wrote a story about Jean DeFoliart, who was having a session on eating insects. that the story was Time Magazine picked it up, and Gene DeFoliart was on one of the late night talk shows. They invited him in to talk about this because it was so strange. But worldwide, we eat, what, about 1,600 species?
So, yes. So, 16. So, a very conservative, recently published estimate stated 1,611 species of insects, but the number is far greater than that. Far greater than 2,000 species are traditionally eaten by humans around the planet. So, we in the United States, in Wisconsin, are exceptions. We tend to look at the eating of insects with a like a side eye, but if we eat their closely related crustaceans, shrimps, crabs, lobsters, it's kind of funny that we're so selective, especially since if you're not a vegetarian, which would be the most sustainable route to take, say a vegan and then a vegetarian, then insects would be next up probably for being a sustainable protein source, far more sustainable than eating cows, pigs, and chickens. So entrepreneurs around the planet, like in Toronto, in Arizona, in Madagascar, have these huge factories now processing crickets and other species to supplement diets around the world in a more sustainable way.
Yeah.
But we don't even have to think about environmental sustainability. You can turn to my friend Joseph Yun, who goes for it as an ambassador of entomophagy, the eating of insects, considering their delicious taste.
Do you eat insects from time to time?
Well, upon occasion, when I'm teaching and giving workshops, I'll share edible insects and talk about the biology as well as the cultural effects or connections we make.
Well, they're pretty pretty high in protein.
Oh, yes. For dry weight, way exceed the vertebrates I just listed before.
And it's not really much of a secret, but I think virtually every one of us has eaten insect parts.
spot on, Larry, because the Federal Drug Administration allows certain parts per 1,000, for example, of fruit flies in your glass of orange juice or in your grains or in your... So, yeah, we're all eating insects.
You wrote that you want people to explore their emotional connections and intimate alliance with insects.
Yeah.
Is that what you were shooting for?
Yeah, that's a huge goal of mine, because as soon as we extend our appreciation, our love beyond our species, Homo sapiens, to non-human primates, to non-primate mammals, to non-mammal vertebrates, to non-vertebrate animals, including our 10 quintillion insect neighbors, I think we can strive to achieve a more sustainable, healthy planet, one in which not only we thrive, but we allow ourselves to survive, to extend our seat on the planet beyond the short geological time scale we have set in front of us.
Barrett, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today. I hope your book sells a lot. Has it been good?
Thanks, Larry. Thank you, Larry. Well, it's a huge, huge pleasure for me to be on a show that I've listened to for years.
Barrett Klein, his book, The Insect Epiphany. That's the main title. How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. I really enjoyed this book, and I hope you have a chance to read it as well. Big thanks to everybody, our producers today, Joel Patnaud, our other producer today, Clara Neipert, technical director Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, wishing you a good afternoon, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. We'll be right back.